Welcome to today's deep dive. I am just so glad you could join us because we have a truly fascinating mission ahead of us today.
We really do. I mean, the material we have to work with is just incredible.
Right. We're pulling from this incredibly rich stack of sources today. We've got gallery exhibition notes, some really dense critical analyses, and even the artist's own structural blueprints.
Which you rarely get to see. It's such
Yeah.
a privilege to have that level of insight.
Totally. And we are using all of this to examine just one single monumental piece of art. It's called Contra Cultura, which translates to counterculture.
Yeah, painted by the artist Jairo Duque.
Exactly. It's this massive 48 by 36 inch acrylic on canvas, and it was exhibited in Whittier, California back in 2019.
And our goal today is to really decipher how this one single canvas manages to capture an entire generational whiplash.
A whiplash that tracks the evolution of nonconformity, right? Like all the way from the 1960s right up to our modern, highly isolated digital existence.
Right. It's a phenomenal document of our times. And what I love is that it challenges this deeply ingrained bias that most of us hold.
Oh, about how we view history.
Yeah. We have this psychological need, I think, for history to be a clean, logical sequence of cause and effect. We desperately want to believe that chapters close cleanly.
Like the ink from the last page doesn't bleed through into the next.
Exactly that.
We usually picture history as this clean, straight highway, right? You picture the past fading away in the rearview mirror, and there's this bright, orderly future right ahead on the horizon.
You assume the old societal struggles just neatly disappear to make room for whatever new technology we invent.
But the core thesis that Jairo Duque presents here just shatters that comforting illusion.
It really does. He argues that old radical energies, those desperate, sweating desires for absolute freedom from the 1960s, they didn't just die out when their political movements seemingly failed.
Right, they transformed.
Exactly. And tragically, they often mutated into these highly sophisticated, modern forms of control.
And to visualize that mutation, the artist completely detonates that imaginary highway we just talked about.
He blows it up.
Literally. I mean, imagine for a second that Jimi Hendrix, a modern cryptocurrency investor, and a deep space probe are all locked in a single room, just crashing into each other violently.
It sounds chaotic because it is.
And somehow, they are all trying to escape the exact same invisible cage. When you look at this canvas, you realize history is not a straight line at all. It is a fierce whirlpool.
It's a vortex.
Okay, let's unpack this because before we can even get into what those past rebels or future digital codes actually look like, we have to talk about how the artist anchors this whole thing.
Right, how he keeps the canvas from just spinning out of control.
Exactly. If you stand back and look at the absolute center of this massive painting, you don't see a historical event. You don't see a protest march.
No, you see an eye.
A single monumental, omniscient eye just staring out, scanning from left to right.
That central eye is the architectural keystone of the entire work.
Yeah.
And in his structural blueprints, Duque explicitly connects this to the tradition of modern art.
Specifically to Pablo Picasso, right?
Yes, to Picasso's famous anti-war masterpiece,
Yeah.
Guernica. Duque refers to this as a symbolic adoption.
Wait, a symbolic adoption. Let's clarify that because is the artist just trying to look intellectual by name-dropping Picasso?
No, not at all. It's not a cheap aesthetic copy. In Guernica, that central eye acts as an absolute, immovable witness to the pure horror of the bombing.
Okay.
In Contra Cultura, he adopts that symbol, but gives it a highly specific dual function for our modern era.
So how does that adoption actually function on this canvas in plain English?
Fair enough. Well, it functions on two levels. First, spatial. The eye acts as the gravitational center organizing all the visual chaos.
So the analog past of the 1960s on the left and the digital future on the right are literally orbiting around it.
Exactly. But the second function is ethical, and this is where it gets incredibly heavy.
Oh, this is the part I love.
Right? This eye is not a neutral security camera just passively recording a street corner. It acts as a looming historical conscience.
It's judging.
Actively judging. It judges the violence of the past, remembers the failures, and issues a really stark warning about the digitized future we are rushing toward.
Which means, when you walk up to this painting, maybe expecting to just look at a cool pop art collage, that central eye completely flips the script on you.
You're not just looking at it.
It's looking at you. You suddenly realize the painting is actually evaluating you. You're standing under its implacable vigilance.
It is a genuinely intimidating experience. The artwork becomes the judge of the modern spectator.
This raises an important question, though. If that heavy judging eye is the center, what exactly is it looking back at?
Well, under its gaze, the entire left side of the canvas unfolds into what the exhibition notes call the archive of memory.
The physical, tangled root system of modern nonconformity.
Exactly. And visually, that left side hits you with incredible force.
The colors are so intensely grounded, like we're talking earthy tones, deep sepias, ash grays, really harsh, heavy blacks.
And we have to mention how he achieved that texture. The artist used a physical image transfer technique to create this section.
It's a fascinating process, right? You literally take a printed image, apply an acrylic medium, press it into the canvas, and then you scrub the paper away with water.
Right, so only the fragmented ink remains embedded in the paint.
The result looks violently torn, like someone went to an alleyway in the late 1960s, ripped a bunch of Irvin concert posters off a brick wall, and forcibly glued them to the canvas.
And emerging from that grit, you see these iconic figures. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, the Beatles.
But, you know, when you see those figures, I have to ask, isn't this just simple nostalgia?
How do you mean?
Like, are we just romanticizing the 60s? That whole Woodstock era of peace and love, which is now just commercialized on fast fashion mall t-shirts?
It's the easiest trap for a viewer to fall into. But Duke's composition strongly refutes that shallow reading.
Because of the context he puts them in.
Yes. There is zero naivete on this canvas. These figures are not invoked as cute pop culture decorations.
Right.
They represent a very specific historical moment when music operated as an actual language of raw resistance. It was a cry against established power, not a product engineered by a corporate board.
And those earthy sepia tones, they aren't there to evoke a warm, fuzzy feeling of the past.
No, they evoke the rawness of a historical scar.
A historical scar. That makes perfect sense when you look at the physical contrast he builds right next to the musicians.
The protest imagery.
Yeah, he includes visual registers inspired by the San Francisco protests against the Vietnam War, and the contrast is absolutely stark.
Flesh versus metal.
Exactly. You have these soft, vulnerable human bodies marching directly against cold, crushing, unfeeling military machinery.
It's a visceral, terrifying depiction of resistance. And what gives this archive of memory its true historical weight is that it refuses to let you get away with the simplified stereotype of the 60s.
We often reduce that entire decade down to white hippies sitting in a meadow, right?
Right. But this canvas explicitly includes powerful imagery of the Black Panther Party.
Which is so crucial because the Black Panthers represent a completely different reality of survival.
Completely different stakes.
We like to remember the acoustic guitars because they feel safe to a modern audience. But the inclusion of the Black Panthers reminds you that this wasn't just about refusing conservative dress codes.
It was about racial justice.
Yes, it was about armed structural demands against systemic police repression.
It was a literal matter of life and death. The counterculture was demanding a total reevaluation of reality across every single axis of society.
And that intense rebellion wasn't just contained to the streets, right? It bled into a desperate search for spiritual meaning, too.
Oh, absolutely. You see it represented in the collage through the poet Allen Ginsberg and imagery from the Hare Krishna movement.
Right, because if you are rejecting the political system, you also have to reject the suffocating materialism of the Cold War era that funded it.
Which brings us to a narrative bridge in the painting that is just fascinating.
The ethical dilemma with the animals.
Yes. The artist groups these anti-war protests right next to a glaring question about animal rights.
Tucked into this chaotic collage, there is an image that directly contrasts a calf with a dog.
It is a brilliant distillation of total system rejection.
And it stops you in your tracks because it is a brutal questioning of our effective hierarchies.
Elaborate on that for the listeners.
Well, it forces you to ask yourself, why, based on pure cultural whim, does one of these animals get a name, sleep in your bed, and get treated as family?
But the other is dinner.
Exactly. The other animal, which has the exact same neurological capacity for pain and fear, is separated from its mother, slaughtered, and wrapped in plastic for mass consumption.
It is a devastating critique of how we compartmentalize our empathy, and it perfectly synthesizes the core ethos of the 60s counterculture being depicted.
They were demanding ideological consistency.
Exactly. They were telling the public that you need to question everything. not just who your government is bombing overseas, but what systems of violence you are quietly funding right on your dinner plate.
The political was every day, and the every day was meant to be profoundly uncomfortable.
You were not allowed to simply look away.
So what does this all mean? How did we get from that visceral, physical rebellion of marching bodies to our current reality?
Because we certainly don't live in the 1960s anymore.
No, we don't. The nature of our nonconformity looks entirely different today. So how do we bridge that gap?
To understand that leap, we have to look at the mechanical construction of the painting itself. The artist physically constructed this transition using a concept he calls el trasteo.
El trasteo, which translates to a move or relocation.
Right. He uses it to represent a massive sociological shift. Imagine entire generations packing up their cultural baggage, their grand hopes for change, and their deepest moral contradictions.
Just lugging those heavy boxes into the next era.
Precisely.
It's like moving into a brand new, hyper-modern, 4K resolution apartment.
Oh, I like that analogy.
You swear you're going to be organized, you're starting a clean new life, but then you unpack the boxes and you realize you just brought the exact same emotional garbage and anxiety into a brighter living room.
That is exactly the dynamic. We dragged our flawed human nature into a higher resolution reality. And what is brilliant is how Duke ensures the canvas itself doesn't physically collapse under the weight of this trasteo.
Right, the medium he chose.
He made a very deliberate choice to use Liquitex acrylic paint over a more delicate medium like watercolor.
The artist's notes mention it has high material visual resistance.
Which means what? Practically speaking.
Basically, it means the acrylic is incredibly dense, it dries rapidly, and it is totally opaque.
Right.
It lets the artist violently slap layer upon layer of contradicting ideas, like painting Jimi Hendrix directly over digital code without it turning into a puddle of ugly brown mud.
The paint holds the friction. If he had used watercolor, combining Janis Joplin with a blockchain algorithm would have structurally destroyed the piece.
Because watercolor is translucent and forgiving.
Exactly. Acrylic covers, it holds firm and it resists. The crude, aggressive nature of the acrylic is the ideology itself.
It mirrors our modern lives, dense, indigestible, friction-filled, overexposed to 247 information.
And you can feel that density as the acrylic drags your eyes across the canvas to the right side.
Where the old analog world just violently fractures into the present and future.
The earthy papers are left behind.
Yeah, the canvas explodes into these intense, electric, almost radioactive blues. The brushstrokes become expansive and liquid.
Representing a borderless ocean of digital data.
And right in the middle, reaching across this divide, is a physical hand. It acts as a bridge, trying to drag those old tangible ideals into this slippery digital environment.
And what is waiting for those ideals in that digital ocean is the ultimate emblem of our current technological era.
Painted right into the blue matrix. Here's where it gets really interesting, because putting Jimi Hendrix in the exact same painting as a cryptocurrency sounds like an absolute delusion.
It really does sound absurd initially. But when you examine the historical origin behind the algorithm, the connection is profound.
Trace it back for us.
You have to look at how Bitcoin was actually born. It emerged from the cypherpunk movement right after the 2008 global financial crisis.
Fueled by a furious anti-establishment spirit.
Exactly. They completely distrusted corrupt central banks and governments bailing out Wall Street while regular people lost their homes.
They were looking for a way to opt out of the system entirely.
Right.
In a way, blockchain was essentially a 1960s commune, just mathematically modified. Instead of moving to the woods, they built a decentralized digital architecture.
It was a digital riot. But what's fascinating here is how tragically that initial rebellious energy mutated over time.
What do you mean?
Well, look at what happened. Today, faith in pure technology has almost completely replaced the old political ideologies we saw on the left side of the canvas.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We trust the code more than politicians.
We transferred our entire desire for freedom into an algorithm.
And the painting captures the tragic irony of that shift. The technology meant to liberate us just built much more efficient glass cages.
You see it depicted in the blue ocean.
Yeah. Social media networks are painted as these tiny floating square windows. They promise global connection, but actually they just act as an attention vacuum.
They absorb you and isolate you from your immediate surroundings. We sought total freedom, and instead we became completely trapped.
And this leads to the most desolate image on the right side.
The silhouettes.
Yeah. Floating in that vast blue ocean, you see the silhouettes of a man and a woman, but their physical borders are melting away, completely dissolving into the digital background.
We have effectively desomatized our existence.
Desomatized, meaning we've stripped away the physical body.
Right.
We traded our tangible, sweating reality for a digital avatar. We went from vulnerable flesh and blood bodies demanding civil rights to anonymous silhouettes that only matter because we generate commercial data.
It represents the complete loss of our real human identity. Our deepest fears and desires are no longer catalysts for a genuine revolution.
They're just information flows for an algorithm trying to sell us shoes.
Exactly. We took the fiery nonconformity of the 60s and let consumerism process it until our social identity just dissolved.
It is a devastating realization. You realize we are willingly erasing our own humanity for convenience. But Duke doesn't just leave us drowning in that blue ocean, does he?
No, he includes one final poetic contrast.
Floating out there in the digital ether.
Yes, a reference to the space probe specifically, the Voyager probe carrying the golden record.
The ultimate historical symbol of human vulnerability.
Think about the audacity of it. Humanity compiled the sounds of Earth, greetings, a mother's heartbeat, our greatest music, and we shot it into the cold cosmos.
Because of a desperate need to not be completely alone in the universe.
We wanted to reach out.
And that is exactly where the paradox hits you. While we use our greatest technological ambitions to try and touch the stars, our screen addiction is stripping us of our real human connection right here on Earth.
We are isolating ourselves while sitting next to each other.
Fading into pixels, losing the very identity we sent into space.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it leaves us with a truly chilling prospect.
What's that?
Well, if we continue to willingly dissolve our physical, messy human identities into mere algorithmic data points, what happens if extraterrestrial life ever actually finds that golden record?
Oh, man, that is a heavy thought.
Imagine they decode the music, hear the heartbeat, and cross the galaxy looking for us. But when they arrive, they don't find the passionate creators who painted art and marched in the streets.
Right, they don't find humans at all.
They just find a perfectly preserved, entirely silent digital archive humming on a server farm, a planet where the algorithms simply outlive the humans they were designed to serve.
Will the algorithm be the actual final legacy we leave behind?
That's the question the painting asks.
That is definitely a thought that will keep you up at night, staring at the ceiling.
Without a doubt.
The next time you unlock your phone to blindly scroll through a feed, I really want you to try and feel the heavy gaze of that monumental eye from the center of this painting.
Remember that it's watching you.
Let it keep your critical spirit awake. Remember that history isn't just a straight highway you can passively cruise down. It's a violent collision of ideas, and you're currently in the room. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.